Phillies fans disappointed by this season could find comfort from the broader perspective offered by one of its employees who's seen it all and shares what he's seen in a new book entitled If These Walls Could Talk, stories from the Philadelphia Phillies dugout, locker room, and press box. Joining me is Phillies Vice President Larry Shank. Larry, thanks for being here on Newsworks tonight.
My pleasure being here. Thank
Congratulations you. On 50 years with the organization, now mostly as head of the team's public relations department.
Correct, yes, from 1964 through 2007.
And in the foreword to your book, famed Philly Larry Boa describes yours as a balancing act between players, media, and fans. How would you describe that job?
The middleman. You're in the middle, and the media was over here. They didn't like the players. The players were over here, and they didn't like the media. So you were the middle person.
You walked a fine line.
Yep.
And when you started, apparently the Phillies were the only team without a media guide.
That is correct. My wife and I handmade the first one the first year, 360 of them. She colored the red Phillies hat with a magic marker at the time. And the next year I went, I had one published without even asking about it. And I think it was $1,100 for 1,000 books. So.
What a time. And 1964, what a year for those well-focused on the Phillies lore.
No doubt about it. You know, I was really a fan, and I'm with the Phillies, and we're in first place, so don't bother me with details, you know. And we're making World Series plans in September, and before you know it, the season was over. You know, it was a blur to me, those 10 games, because we were so busy planning for a World Series.
Is it true that they printed up playoff tickets?
Oh, we got the World Series tickets. We have them. I have some at home, yes. We had to print them. We printed the World Series cover because that was in color back then. It took longer to print the color. But don't tell anybody. We saved that, and 2 years later, we used it as a yearbook cover.
Quite a dubious collector's piece. Yeah. Of course, for a team that started in, what, 1883, making the Phillies the oldest continuous one-name, one-city franchise?
Right.
And with that time, and given the Phillies' history, they also share some dubious distinctions as well.
Correct.
Most losses.
Most losses.
Yeah, but during your time, you saw not one but two golden eras.
That's correct. We had the 70s and then the recent one, you know, been to five World Series, you know, out of the seven the Phillies have had. We had great runs, you know. I thought the 80 parade and 1980 parade was never be topped. It was topped in 2008. It was really unbelievable what the fan reaction.
You're saying even stronger than that for the first 1980, even though that came after, what, 7 decades of futility?
Yep. The first one we thought was the most – it is the most special one, you know, because it's the first one. But 2008, the fans were the parade was humongous compared to 1980, really.
Now, the main interface for so many fans, and when you talk about media, is the broadcast team and the renowned team of Callis and Ashburn. They were at the helm when the Phillies won in 1980.
Right. But they didn't broadcast.
How's that?
That was Major League Baseball rules at the time. And there were a lot of protests by our fans. And after that year, the home broadcasters got to broadcast the game on radio.
But could the savvy fan turn off the TV volume and turn up the radio?
Exactly.
So that's what you had to do.
Yeah.
Richie Ashburn, of course, one of the great Phillies. Although in your book, you say the greatest of them all was Michael Jack Schmidt.
Yes, I think so. I mean, he has records that nobody else matched, although Jimmy Rollins is creeping up on him. He's already passed him in games and hits. But Schmidt, nobody played third base like that for us, you know. Whitey was a great ball player, an all-star batting, our last batting champion, which is a long time ago. And he may have been the most popular sports person in the history of the Philadelphia, you know, Richie Ashburn. He was a player. He was a broadcaster. He wrote for the Bulletin. He wrote for the Daily News, you know. So he was known for a long time.
What does it say about the Phillies fans in part that Michael Jack Schmidt was often reviled, especially as a rookie, and that also goes for other great players? Richie Allen comes to mind.
Yeah. Phillies fans are extremely passionate. When you're doing well, they let you know. When you're not doing well, they let you know. So that's fine, you know. In Los Angeles, they show up in the third inning and leave in the sixth inning. You know, it's a different. There's a lot of passion in Philadelphia. They expect you to play hard and get dirty and be a blue-collar worker. Schmidt was effortless in his way he played the game. He didn't play with a lot of emotion. He didn't get his uniform dirty, you know, but he was a heck of a ball player. He wasn't really, I don't think, accepted until the Hall of Fame ceremonies up in Cooperstown. And then when he became a Hall of Famer, I think everybody really accepted him. And he does a fabulous job for us now on TV on Sundays.
Who are the Phillies who more readily come to mind as embracing that blue-collar image?
Darren Dalton, I think, was one of them. You know, John Kruk, the 93 team, the whole 93 team. I think the 2008 team, Chase Utley, you know, Jimmy Rollins, and Ryan Howard certainly are they're going to be the greatest position players at that position in Phillies history, those three guys. So we've had a great run. You know, it doesn't go on forever. You know, things go in cycles in sports, and we're in the other cycle now. We're heading the other way.
So by that, can we infer that we're not even at the bottom of the cycle yet?
I think we're close to the bottom of the cycle. You know, I stepped down in 2007. 2008, they won the World Series. 2009, they're in the World Series. So maybe I was the problem.
I don't think so. Larry, understandably, in player interviews before, during, or after the game, they are speaking pretty much in boilerplate and cliche. Mm-hmm. Tell us about situations where you've seen a player and or manager really let down his guard.
Well, it does happen. Dallas Green blew up one time at Jason Stark in 1981.
Sports writer Jason Stark.
Yeah, when we had the split season, you know. The PR guy always goes to the manager's office after the game and kind of reviews things that might go happening and try to calm him down. And if he wants to vent, you know, pick on me to vent type of thing. So you try to help him when they can, and you try to do the same thing with the players. You try to coach them a little bit, help them a little bit. But they're under the gun, and sometimes they will fly off. You know, I've had cases where Ron Reed had his fist pumped ready to go after a player, and I'm in the middle of it, you know. Danny Ozark said some things sometimes that didn't make much sense, and you have to zig and zag around that. Jim Fregosi was very good. You know, he handled the media very well. He could handle the media with his eyes. He could answer a question with his eyes, you know. One time we had made a trade, and I was sitting and having lunch with Jim. I said, these are some of the questions you might get asked, Jimmy. He took his reading glasses and slid them down the end of his notes. He said, Baron, I don't need your coaching.
Just like that.
I said, Jimmy, you're right.
On the topic of coaches, tell us about your impressions of Charlie Manuel.
Charlie Manuel is a great guy, a player's manager.
At the time, probably necessary after Larry Boa's tenure.
Yes, yes. It was a different, you know, Danny Ozark and Charlie Manuel pretty much the same. Larry Boa and Dallas Green were kind of much the same, you know, two explosive personalities. Danny and Charlie let the players play, didn't criticize the players in the media. Toughest nails behind the doors where people didn't know it, you know. Charlie, the most amazing thing with me with Charlie, he was the same way every day. He was up every day. He didn't get down, and he was preached positive thoughts to people, talked to the players every day. And he was unique, really unique manager.
Has the pendulum swung back the other way with Ryan Sandberg?
Ryan Sandberg, a very quiet person, and has a different approach. Is still very difficult, can be very tough, but people don't know that. It's a difficult job. In my experience, and I'm not an expert, if a manager's been around 4 or 5 years, it becomes a little bit stale. His message doesn't carry anymore, and it's time for a change. I've seen it with Gene Mauch. I saw it with Fregosi. I saw it with Danny Ozark, and I saw it with Charlie Manuel. It's just,
and
it
whoever
happens.
One considers to be the greats, it could still happen. Yep. I suppose rare is the manager who stays on a long time, although Atlanta's was there at the helm for quite a
Bobby
while.
Yeah, Bobby Cox. And then there's a guy named Connie Mack.
Oh, yeah, him.
50 years with the A's, but he was part owner, so that helped a little bit.
They didn't have free agency yet then.
That's correct.
There wasn't much option for the players.
No, right.
Staying on topic with Jim Fregosi, he at the helm of that 93 hardscrabble team. Mm-hmm. How much of that was image, and how much was he able to manage and shape that image of that team?
It started in spring training. He felt there was a special bond that these guys could have. And we had a fight with the Cardinals over in St. Petersburg that year in spring training, which you don't have in spring training. And the team unified. And he also recognized that Darren Dalton was his quarterback. He was the best leader I've ever been around. Darren could take a guy one-on-one, sit down with him, get to him. He could go to lunch with a guy and talk to him. He could grab a guy by the throat. He could back a guy up in his locker and threaten him. You know, he was the ultimate leader. And Jimmy turned the clubhouse over to him, and Darren ran the clubhouse. And they were an odd group. There was the Macho's Row at the end of the clubhouse. It was not the greatest place for a PR guy to invade, you know, because you had Mitch Williams and Kruk and Lenny Dykstra. And,
enter at your own risk.
And Curt Schilling. And it was like, you know, you go down there to ask him to come out and do a media interview, you're taking your life in your hands, so to speak, you know.
To the extent that it's important for the players to have a leader among their rank, do the Phillies have one now?
Chase, but he's a different leader than Darren was, you know. Chase is very quiet. He leads by example, you know. Darren did lead by example, but Darren also was very, as I said, he could pat you on the back. He has a kick in the butt. But Darren was unique. He was the PR's, he was our savior in 93 because that was a tough bunch to deal with, and he would help us out, you know. After the games, especially at home, they'd all be in the trainer's room after the game, the whole 25 guys. And I got an empty clubhouse of media. So I walk in, and that's not the easiest thing to do, walk into where we're not welcome. And he'd say, hey, I got 10 more minutes on my ice on my knee, and I'll be out. Mickey, Terry, you go out and help Baron, you know. And that was really welcome, you know.
Who was the leader or leaders in that winning 1980 team?
Pete Rose.
Without question.
Without question. Yeah. He was so positive.
He was the newbie.
Yeah. He was at his locker after every game, no matter what he did, whether it was win, lose, three hits or no hits. He was always there and set the tone.
Mr. Baseball.
He believed in media. It meant money back then than if you were in the media all the time. You know, it meant money. You could make more money that way. And he was such a positive influence. He was great to be around. 5 years with him was awesome, really.
You have a whole chapter devoted to scouting. Speak to the importance of having a strong scouting staff and developing a minor league system.
Well, that's how we won in 1950 with the Whiz Kids. That's how we won in 1980. And this recent group was that way, too. The 1993 team was kind of a hodgepodge, crazy bunch of mixed-up people. The 83 team, which went to the World Series, was a bunch of old players, veterans that were put together. You don't generally win that way. You have to sign, develop your own players, and bring them along. We did that, and that's how we won. And you look around baseball, the Cardinals are exactly the same sample. They develop their own players, and they've done well. The Atlanta Braves also.
Your book touches on so many wonderful Phillies player profiles, including Pete Rose. And in a bit of editorializing, you seem to make a case for him, perhaps at one point on this, the 25th anniversary of him being banned from baseball, perhaps being seen in a new light. And you equate it to those players who have been tainted by performance-enhancing drug suspicion or direct use.
He had over 3,000 hits, never used any PEDs, you know. He made a mistake. You know, betting on baseball is a rule that you can't do. There's a sign in every clubhouse. Major League Baseball comes around to every clubhouse in spring training and talks about it. But I think it's time to forgive and forget him. I mean, that's the way it should be in this country. He hasn't helped himself a little bit, but I think he belongs in the Hall of Fame. He's our greatest leader in hits. That should be a Hall of Famer.
When you started in the mid-60s, baseball was inarguably America's game.
Yeah.
Not so much now.
It's gone from a sport to a huge business. And there's a lot more competition. The NFL has certainly come on strongly, and the NHL and the NBA. And there's a lot more on TV now than there was back then. You know, when I started in 64, every Sunday was the only television game you had locally. So it's still a sport because from April till the end of September, every day is baseball. And that's something you can't take away from any. Other sports can't match that.
Talk about the change in media. It's affected, obviously, the papers we spoke earlier about. There once being four papers, each with a great sports column.
It's huge, the change that, you know, we had, when I started, we had to make the announcements sometimes for the morning paper, the Inquirer. The next one needed to be the evening paper, the Bulletin. And if you made two in a row to the other paper, they would complain about this. Nowadays, in seconds, the whole world knows what you did. You can communicate so much differently. People talk about social media. Heck, I did social media back in my early years. We bought drinks for the writers.
Let's talk about two Phillies who've been around almost as long as you. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. The Philly Fanatic.
Philly Fanatic, yeah.
1978.
We were in a staff meeting and Bill Giles' office, and Dennis Lehman had been out to San Diego and saw the San Diego Chicken and came back and said, I think we need a mascot. The Philly fans would go fanatical over it. So Bill contacted the creators of Sesame Street and had them design a costume. And we weren't sure that this was going to succeed. I'm a purist. You know, I like this, nothing else on the field. I was wrong. You know, it's the greatest thing we ever had. I mean, the Fanatic is so entertaining. He's lovable by everybody. He's the best mascot in any sport.
Bar none. Another Philly who's been around quite a long time, 1972 PA announcer Dan Baker.
Dan Baker, what a professional he is. You know, he's so dedicated, so enthusiastic about the job. We have various ceremonies throughout the year. You give him the script and it's done. You don't have to worry about it. He's really good, and he's part of our organization. I mean, he's the image that the fans know.
talk about the image of the Phillies and how you see that moving forward. Of course, they sold out and set attendance records just 3 or 4 years ago. Now, not so much.
Not so much. You know, it goes with the winning and losing. You know, winning is the greatest thing in the world. You can have all kinds of promotions you want.
You can have a brand new park.
Right. And if you don't win, it's not the same thing. It's very strange. Our attendance is not good. But we had 23,000 last night when you were there. You were one of the 23,000, which is low for us. Down in Baltimore, they're in first place. They had 15,000 people. So how do you explain that?
Do you explain that?
I don't know. I can't figure that out. They were playing Tampa Bay, and that should be a good crowd. I mean, Baltimore's got a great team this year. You know, they lead the league in home runs, the major leagues in home runs.
And isn't theirs the original revisionist stadium in Camden Yards?
Yeah, Bill Giles went down and saw Camden Yards, came back and says, we need to get something like that in Philadelphia.
And now almost every city either has or wants to get something like that.
And we were able to visit some of the newer ballparks that were built and learn the mistakes that they did and prove them. And Citizens Bank Park is a special place to go to. And it's a great hangout. Our demographics have changed. Younger people are going there now, you know. And there are people who are coming in later in the game, and they're just – it's a social place to be. It's a place to be seen, really.
Hindsight's 20/20, but speak to the thinking, the calculus of the multi-use stadium, and I'm talking about here in Philly, what was that stadium?
Yeah, we were so glad to get out of Connie Mack Stadium because there was no parking, no amenities, you know, and Veterans Stadium was the greatest thing going. That was the stadium of the era, you know, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Atlanta had these round stadiums, multi-purpose. AstroTurf was something new. And after a while, it became very worn down, the Vet did. It was owned by the city, and we needed to get the ballpark. We needed a ballpark. A stadium is for football, 65,000 people. We don't need 65,000 seats for a Phillies game because you can have 40,000 people and you got 20,000 empty seats. So the supply and demand was not there for us, you know, business-wise. So we had a nice ceremony for them to close Veterans Stadium in 2003.
And a heck of an implosion.
And a heck of an implosion. It took 4 years to build the ballpark, 62 seconds to implode it.
And then up from its ashes came Citizens Bank Park, now 10 years on.
It's hard to believe.
What are some of the newest ideas on the horizon for trying to entice and retain fans and fan
interest? I don't know. I'm not a part of the – they have staff meetings every Wednesday. I don't have to go to that anymore. I graduated from that after all these years. So we need to service our fans right now and continue emphasizing the atmosphere, the experience, the ballpark, the fanatic, and develop some young players. You develop young players, and they stay with you for years, and the fans start identifying with them. And we did that in 1980. We did that again in 2005, 6, 7, 8, and there. You know, Chase Utley, Jimmy Rollins were been around. They were homegrown, as were Larry Boa, Mike Schmidt, Greg Luzinski, Bob Boone. You know,
but those players and across the league, be they a Derek Jeter or Mariano Rivera, it's rarer and rarer for a player to stay with
one
team.
Exactly, you know.
Larry Shank, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight. Phillies Vice President Larry Shank, author of the book entitled If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Philadelphia Phillies Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Box.